Chapter 2. Technically, the War Cabinet should have had its meeting in the Presidential Palace on New Rio, because the President herself was the chair, and ultimately held responsibility for all Commonwealth policy. That was the structure laid out in the Commonwealth Constitution. Real politic was a little different. None of the Intersolar Dynasty leaders present, Nigel Sheldon, Heather Antonia Halgarth, Alan Hutchinson and Hans Brandt, were keen to be absent from their respective planets for long. And as Earth provided direct train links to all the Big 15, it was their preferred choice of world. The senators Justine Bernelli, Crispin Goldreich and Ramon D.B. were based on Earth anyway. And the two admirals, Keim and Columbia, certainly didn't have the clout to nominate a different location, not after the public beating the Navy was taking after the lost 23, however unfair it might have been. Patricia Cantill had no option but to bow to the majority. It might have been the Navy that was taking the brunt of the criticism in the media, but the Unisphere polls were revealing a significant percentage questioning the overall leadership. Much as it irked her, she arranged for the meeting to be held at the Senate Hall in Washington, D.C. The participants assembled in one of those secure underground rooms so beloved of governments whenever they constructed emergency facilities. In an age when force fields could deflect atom laser shots and 100-megaton blasts with relative ease, Patricia didn't really see the point of digging out warrens of rooms 100 meters below the aging Senate Hall building. But for the lack of windows, the chamber could have been any high-status corporate boardroom. A long tarnwood table sat atop an emerald carpet patterned with a huge intersolar Commonwealth seal. Portraits of every past Senate First Minister gazed down at the table with various expressions of superiority. All very somber and expensive. Typical of a budget that would never be held up to public scrutiny. The War Cabinet all stood when Elaine Doy entered the room. Following 2 paces behind her, Patricia was quietly pleased to see that courtesy was extended, at least. The true powers in the Commonwealth were still acknowledging formal procedures, for the moment. None of the other Cabinet members had aides with them. Patricia was the only one. She couldn't actually recall being in the physical presence of quite so many masterclass players before. It was intimidating, even for someone as familiar with the process of high government as she. And she knew Elaine was nervous. For once, not just about her own term. The latest batch of statistics from the prime assault was shocking. Elaine took her place at the head of the table and asked the others to be seated. Patricia sat at her left, with the First Minister, Oliver Tam, on her right. The tall double doors closed, and the chamber was automatically screened. Everyone lost contact with the Unisphere.
"Isn't the S.I. attending?"
Crispin asked churlishly. Elaine glanced at Patricia and gave a small nod of permission.
"Not at this stage," Patricia said.
"Although it appears to be as disturbed as we are by the invasion, and it provided a great deal of assistance at the time, we still cannot be certain about its ultimate allegiance. As it is humans who are facing the brunt of the prime attack, we feel that we alone should determine our response. If we decide we need its aid or advice, we will, of course, ask. Until then, the fundamental decision-making process should be ours and ours alone."
If Crispin was annoyed at her reply, he didn't show it.
"Thank you,"
Elaine said.
"I now call this first meeting of the War Cabinet to order. It is here today that we must determine the nature of our response to the clear and absolute threat posed by the Prime Aliens. I don't feel I understate the enormity of the task we face when I say the outcome of this meeting could well determine not just the future of humanity as a species, but even if we have a future. The decisions we are faced with will be extremely difficult, and no doubt unpopular in some quarters. I, for one, am quite prepared to sacrifice popularist action in preference to do what is both right and necessary. I would like to call on Admiral Keim to give us a brief summary of the terrible assault we have endured,
and then the Navy's analysis of what we might expect next from the Primes. When we have all absorbed that, I shall open the floor to policy decisions. Admiral.
Thank you, Madam President.
Wilson Keim looked around the table, saddened at the lack of friendly faces.
We all know it was bad. We knew the size of the Prime civilization at Dyson Alpha, and the kind of resources it has available to it. Yet our initial preparation was wholly inadequate. The reason for that is quite simple. We refuse to believe that an attack on this scale would ever happen. There simply is no rational explanation for it. We have seen that the Prime civilization's industrial capacity is probably equal to, if not larger, than that of the entire Commonwealth. If they needed expansion space and more material resources, then it would be considerably cheaper for them to exploit star systems next to their own, rather than come after ours. Yet they chose not to follow a logical development pattern. They found out about us from Bose and Verbiken, and almost the first thing they did was build a series of wormholes to reach us. It looks as if the worst-case scenario for the envelopment was right. Someone set up the barrier around Dyson Alpha to keep them contained.
What about Dyson Beta?
Alan Hutchinson asked.
It remains an unknown, Wilson said. As does the reason for the Dyson Alpha barrier coming down. What we have to address today is the consequence of the Primes being freed. As a result of their attack, we now estimate the human death toll on the lost 23 planets to be approximately 37 million.
There was total silence around the table. Most of the cabinet stared down at the glossy wooden surface, not wanting to make eye contact with one another. Wilson cleared his throat self-consciously and continued.
From the nature of the attacks, and the intelligence we have gathered subsequently, it appears that the aim of the Primes is to secure the industrial facilities on the lost 23 planets. Unlike us, they don't appear to care about preserving the planetary environments. What we saw of their home world seems to support this. It was massively industrialized, and the pollution was orders of magnitude beyond anything we experienced here on Earth during the worst of the 21st century. Their priorities, therefore, are completely different from ours. That made them very difficult to predict. However, now they are in the open and we're able to observe their activities directly, we can determine what actions they will have to pursue next. For instance, they will have to build up their occupation forces on Lost 23 in order to utilize them properly and secure them against any counterstrike we make. They will also mount a second attack against the Commonwealth, then a third and a fourth. They will keep on attacking and pushing us back and back onto fewer worlds until we have none left.
What makes you certain of that?
Heather asked.
We are at war,
Wilson said. He saw her glossed lips tighten at the phrase, censure leaking out of the flawless skin of her mid-50s face like trace pheromones. Even though she was in a chic, formal dark blue suit with her ginger hair folded into a neat braid, there was no way of disguising the authority she possessed. Heather was the only female head of a Big 15 intersolar dynasty, her feminine appearance, a very thin cloak worn over ruthless ambition and a razor-sharp political instinct. Just like him and everyone else seated around the table, she hated being given bad news.
War, by its nature, cannot be a static situation, he continued, meeting her stare levelly. They know that we will never accept the loss of those 23 planets. Either they continue to expand across the Commonwealth, wiping us out of galactic history, or we will do the same to them.
Are you suggesting we commit genocide against them?
Ramon D.B. asked lightly.
Are you suggesting we become the victims of genocide?
Wilson countered.
This is not a war as we have fought them before. This is not a strategic struggle over key resources. We're not fighting for control over tribal lands or trade routes to the new colonies. Both us and the Primes are intersolar. There is no shortage of anything in the galaxy. They came here with one purpose, to kill us and to capture our worlds. In that case, we have experienced an analogous war in our history, Hans Brandt said. It would seem as if they are waging a religious crusade against us.
You could be right, Wilson said. Religion, or some ideological variant of it, was certainly one of the more popular theories among the strategic analysis teams.
Their motivation can't easily be explained any other way.
We can worry about the reason later, Nigel said. You've summarized where we stand. What does the Navy want to do next?
What do you need?
We're proposing to meet the prime aggression with a three-stage approach. First, a heavy infiltration and sabotage offensive on the Lost 23. Tie the primes up on each planet, slow them down, divert their resources away from readying their next attack while we prepare for stage two. I'm curious about the kinds of forces you envisage to pull that off, Alan Hutchinson said. Commando-style troop units will be dropped onto the Lost 23 through wormholes that will open for a very short duration. They'll cause as much disruption as possible, combined with a comprehensive intelligence-gathering operation. So far, we know very little about the primes. This should help expand our knowledge base considerably. We're hoping to perform several snatch missions so we can begin interrogation and memory reading procedures.
Just what kind of numbers are you talking about here? Alan asked keenly.
To make any decent impact, you're going to need a lot of these guerrilla fighters.
We're planning on sending an initial force of around 10,000 troops to each planet.
10,000? Christ, man, you're talking about raising an army of 250,000 people.
We don't see that as a problem, Raphael said smoothly. The new Navy ground troop service will be open to volunteers from the general population, of course. And history shows we'll have a great many aspirants. Even multi-lifers tend to get aggressive when threatened. And just in case, we have a large reserve of people who can be more easily persuaded. People, in fact, more suited to this kind of work than most. He opened his hands wide in reasonable appeal. Please, most of the last few days have been spent drawing up these responses and examining their feasibility. We're not throwing out panic ideas here. Deploying these troops is not only possible, it is essential. We must regain the initiative.
Very well, Hans said. What's stage two?
A fleet, Wilson said flatly. A very big fleet of warships. Not the kind we have now. We need to approach this from a radical perspective. We have to consider starships like the Second Chance and the St. Asaph as our kitty hawks, not even prototypes. We were lazy back then, putting together what we could with damn near off-the-shelf components.
He glanced over at Nigel.
I'm not criticizing. They were right for the time, but this is a new age that could well see us obliterated if we don't recognize it. We need fast ships, not with the Mark V or VI hyperdrives that are on the drawing board. I need a Mark 10 or more, a speed that can take us to Dyson Alpha in a week. They've got to be well protected, shields as strong as the original Dyson barriers were. They've got to have real weaponry, not nuclear missiles, not energy beams. Give me relativistic attack drones. Each warship loaded with a salvo of 100 of the damn things, which can all strike with the same power the Desperado unleashed. And most of all, I need thousands of them. Not dozens, not hundreds, thousands. Enough to challenge that goddamn armada of ordinary ships which the Primes have. During their attack on the Lost 23, they sent over 30,000 ships through those wormholes. And they've got 100 times that many back in their home system. If we're going to go up against them, then we need to put the industrial output equivalent to a big 15 behind this effort. Churn them out the way we do cars and trains. FTL ships are the sole advantage we have over the primes right now. They don't have them. If we can get that advanced technology working and deployed, then we stand a chance. With the kind of strike mobility I'm talking about, we can outmaneuver them at a strategic level. We can block their next attack. That's our second stage. Then, after that, we can scour space between here and Dyson Alpha to find out where that bastard Hell's Gateway staging post is and destroy it. Stage 3. Threat elimination.
Sounds good to me, Nigel said.
He nodded his approval.
At least you're talking the talk, thinking outside the box.
We need that badly.
It's bloody expensive talk,
Crispin murmured.
I don't believe you just said that,
Justine shot at him. The unexpected sharpness in her tone made everyone turn to look at her. It was pure gore.
37 million humans dead, and you're complaining about the cost of defending ourselves. Didn't you hear what the Admiral just told us? The alternative is death. Real death, not just an inconvenient sleep of absence while your clinic grows you a new body. You will die, Crispin. And that lasts forever.
I wasn't saying it was too expensive, my dear. I'd just like to point out that our finances will have to undergo a similar radical restructuring to pay for it. That's if this wonderful new technology can be made to work.
He looked pointedly at Nigel, then Wilson.
The theories are perfect, Nigel said evenly. Getting them to work in practice. Well, Crispin, that's where all your money comes in. It'll be your taxes that get raised,
Crispin pointed out.
And do you really think any of us gives a flying fuck about that right now? Get the Treasury to crunch the numbers, slap 20% or 40% on taxes, work out the loans and bond issues we'll have to float. Nobody cares about the inflation or recession or unsustainable growth it'll cause. None of that crap matters if we lose. If we don't have the money available to make this work, there won't be any finance market. We'll be dead. We at this table have to recognize this, even if we can never say so in public.
It's not just finance, Heather said.
She nodded in Wilson's direction.
I like your thinking on this.
Team effort, he grunted.
Sure, but your team's heading in the right direction. We have to think way out of left field and cooperate for a change. What gives me a fright is trying to realign our manufacturing capacity on this scale. It won't be smooth, yet it must be done.
The SI could probably help,
Oliver Tam said.
Possibly, Heather said.
She sounded like a schoolmistress displeased with a disruptive pupil. She exchanged a look with the other three dynasty heads.
We'll need to pull the rest into line.
They're smart enough, Nigel said. And we have our own arrangements between ourselves.
Heather gave a small shrug.
What about the refugee situation?
Ramon D.B. inquired.
What place do they have in all these plans?
Right now we have the entire surviving population from the Lost 23 saturating the rest of the Commonwealth. They have no homes, no jobs, no life left. They look to us, to government, for leadership, some acknowledgement of their plight. There are hundreds of thousands of people flooding into Silvergalda, which can't cope. I'm told the outside of Lidington is beginning to resemble some kind of medieval refugee camp, with no water, no sanitation, and precious little food. And there's the one big problem which I haven't heard raised here today. The displacement. People on every world within 100 light-years of the Lost 23 are either taking vacations on the other side of the Commonwealth, or trying to sell up and buy a house on a world where they think they're going to be safe. They are afraid, and with good reason. What do we do about this? We must show them we know and understand their situation, that we will take action to resolve it.
Not today, and not in here,
President Doi said. It was said in such a decisive and firm manner that she drew surprised glances from several people around the table. Ramon actually opened his mouth in astonishment.
This is the War Cabinet, Senator Ramon, she said.
In here we decide military strategy, that's all.
The displaced are an item for the General Civil Cabinet, if not a full debate in the Senate.
But they do impinge on military matters, Ramon said. They will affect the whole economy.
No, Elaine said quickly.
The numbers are huge, admittedly. But in overall percentage terms, they barely register. I will not let this cabinet get bogged down by the minutiae of problems which are not in its direct remit.
You are out of order, Senator. Please give the floor to someone else. Alan was making little attempt to hide his smile.
One or two of the others looked mildly bemused. A positive and decisive Doi was not something they encountered very often. Realizing her sudden authority, she asked,
Admiral Columbia, do you envisage any policy change to our current planetary defenses?
No changes, ma'am. The force fields were extremely successful, even on the LOS 23. We have plans to upgrade all city and civil area force fields, anticipating the Primes will launch a second attack. Arms manufacturers are also increasing production of combat aerobots for us, which proved invaluable during the preliminary bombardment. Electronic warfare systems are also a priority. But those are all purely defensive systems. All they can do is minimize damage in the event of an attack. To stop the attack, we need that fleet.
Point taken, Admiral. I think we can move to a vote on the overall strategy.
I would also like to mention Stage 4, Columbia said.
Stage 4?
Yes, ma'am. The Seattle Project. The kind of weapon we can use to take the fight directly to Dyson Alpha.
I wasn't aware we'd even reached prototype stage yet.
Hopefully it will arrive within a few months, Wilson said. You know physicists, they don't like deadlines. Not that they ever meet them anyway.
So it's not something we have to consider immediately? The president asked.
No, Wilson agreed cautiously.
But Admiral Columbia is right. Ultimately, we may have to make the decision to use it.
We can fight them with warships, Columbia said. We can slow them down. We can possibly even force them back, though any prolonged war will be extremely costly to us, and not just in monetary terms. But if ultimately they prove implacably hostile to us, for whatever reason, then it will have to be used.
Genocide, Elaine whispered. Dear God.
It would be a collective decision, Hans told her.
We would make it together and share it with you.
The Seattle Project should continue to receive top priority, Columbia said.
Yes, the president said cheerily. Very well. If no one else has any issues, I'd like to proceed to a vote on Admiral Keim's proposal for a three-stage approach to engaging the prime threat.
Proposed, Heather said.
Seconded, Alan said.
Very well, the president said. Those in favor?
She counted the raised hands.
Unanimous.
Outside the cabinet room, little groups of aides were hanging around in the long corridor, gossiping with one another. When the doors opened, they all quietened down and waited for their respective chief to walk past, before attaching themselves like so many iron filings. Justine had almost reached Sue Pikin and Ross Gant Wainwright, the two senior staffers she'd inherited with Thompson's office, when Ramon D.B. caught up with her.
That was unlike you, he said softly.
Justine stopped and gave him an impatient look, all ready to give him a snappy answer. The bright overhead lighting glinted off small droplets of sweat on his brow. His midnight black ock tattoos were now quite visible across his cheeks and hands, a result of his previously ebony skin acquiring a greyish pallor. When she glanced down, she could see how tight his generous robe was. Her annoyance drained away.
You look tired, she said, and put a hand on his arm. I don't suppose you've been taking it easy.
He smiled fondly.
Have you?
My body is in its early 20s again. I can do the late nights and stress.
You can't. Please don't go reminding me about your body at that age.
He put one hand playfully over his chest.
My heart
can only take so much. By the way, you look tremendous in black.
Rami, look at those rings. You'll never get them off. Your fingers have swollen so much.
She took his hand and held on to it, examining the jewelry that was almost buried by pulpy flesh. He squirmed like a guilty child.
Don't nag, woman.
I'm not nagging. I'm telling you this straight. Either you start looking after yourself, or I personally will cart you off to the clinic for rejuvenation.
As if either of us can take time off for that right now.
He paused, uncertain of himself.
I heard about L.A. Galactic. Talk in the Senate dining room is that you knew the boy who was killed.
Yeah, I knew him. I was the one who put Navy intelligence on him.
Ramon gave her black dress a suspicious stare.
I hope you're not blaming yourself for his death.
No.
You forget, my dear, I really do know you.
Did the Senate dining room know that the boy was killed by the same person who killed Thompson?
Yes. We're quietly but firmly pressing Senate security for some results.
He lowered his voice to a whisper.
Confidence in both branches of the Navy is not terribly high right now.
It'll improve.
For a moment, Justine considered telling him about the Starflyer. Ramon would make a superb ally in the Senate, but he really wasn't in good shape, and that would just add to his burden.
Not yet, she told herself. I'm sorry, Doy, cut you off in there, she said. I believe we do need to consider the refugee problem.
Actually, she was right to say that, he said, and smiled broadly. I'm just not used to our dear president being quite so forceful. It could well be we have waved goodbye to a politician and got a stateswoman in return. Now that would be a first.
We'll see. I'm not so sure I believe in an age of miracles just yet. But I'll be happy to back you up in the Senate on some kind of aid package for the refugees.
She caught sight of Wilson Keim talking to Crispin, and leaned forward to give Ramon a quick kiss.
I have to go. I'll see you in the dining room, yes?
Of course. Justine hurried over to Wilson as he and Crispin shook hands. Several aides were waiting to pounce, and she could see Columbia coming out of the cabinet room. She wasn't quite up to another direct confrontation with him right now.
Admiral, could we talk for a moment, please?
Wilson nodded amicably.
Certainly, Senator.
In private. There's a conference room just down here.
Wilson's hesitation was hardly noticeable.
Very well.
Justine's e-butler gave the door an open code. Her aides had reserved the room as soon as they all knew where the War Cabinet meeting was to be held. Wilson followed her in, his face registering polite curiosity. Then he saw Paula Milo sitting at the table inside, and frowned.
What is this?
He asked. Sorry to put you on the spot, Wilson, Justine said. But you probably know Admiral Columbia and I had a disagreement on certain security matters. And he fired Investigator Mayo from Navy Intelligence. Wilson held up a hand.
I'm sorry, Senator, but Raphael has my complete confidence. I don't do office politics, not at this level. In case you hadn't noticed, there's a war on, and we could well lose.
He turned back to the door.
The Guardians have been running an operation on Mars for 20 years, Paula said.
Wilson froze, his hand already extended to open the door. After a moment he said,
There's nothing on Mars.
Believe me, I know.
You were there for 10 hours over 300 years ago, Justine said. I was watching the live television broadcast. I remember seeing Lewis, Orkeston, and you stepping out onto the surface. It was the first time in a great many years I was proud of our country again. You were putting up the stars and stripes when Nigel butted in.
Wilson turned around, anger flushing his cheeks.
So?
The Guardians were using the Arabia Terra Station to relay their information back to Earth.
What sort of information?
We're not sure. Navy intelligence made one attempt to run diagnostic routines through the equipment up there.
It appeared to be standard environmental sensors.
I don't get it.
Wilson shook his head, clearly irritated.
The Guardians are terrorists. What do they want with Martian environment data?
We don't know, Paula said. But the Paris office is winding down their investigation.
Ah, that's it.
Wilson gave Justine a disdainful glance. You want me to pressure Raphael into keeping the investigation open?
You have been on the receiving end of a Guardian operation, Paula said. More than most, you know how serious and effective they can be. They nearly destroyed the Second Chance. A 20-year operation is not something they would undertake lightly. It would have to be exceptionally important to them. We have got to find out what it is.
Wilson let out a hiss of air between his teeth.
Maybe. But if it is truly this important, I don't believe Raphael would ignore it. He's many things. Aggressive, ambitious, intense, unforgiving, yes. But never stupid.
Everyone has blind spots, Wilson, Justine said. Paula was fired for political reasons, for not being quick enough to produce results.
130 years on a case with no result is very reasonable grounds for dismissal in my book, Wilson said. No offense.
You heard about the L.A. Galactic incident? Justine asked. An assassin killed the Guardian's courier, who was bringing their Martian data back for them. It was the same assassin who destroyed the black market arms dealer on Venice Coast. He also murdered my brother. So he's not working for the government, and he can't be working for the Guardians.
Who then? Wilson asked.
Good question. The Paris office might be able to find the answer. If they keep hunting.
Wilson looked from Justine to Paula. What are you asking for?
Ask Raphael to keep Navy intelligence on the Martian inquiry, not to let up.
Maybe, Wilson said. I'll have to think about all this.
After an investment of 25 years, most of the planets in Phase 1 space were now linked by maglev express lines, providing a fast, efficient service. And based on that success, CST was busy expanding the network out across the planets of Phase 2 space. But for all its imagined importance as the link world to far away, Boongate still hadn't got a maglev track. CST was vague about the timetable for installation. It had taken the standard express from Paris 40 minutes to reach Boongate CST station, sliding smoothly up alongside Platform 2 at 2200 hours local time. There were only 5 platforms in the main terminal building, but each of them was bustling with waiting passengers when Rennie and Tarlo stepped out from the first-class double-decker carriage. It was raining outside, and the train was dripping onto the track. A chilly night wind blew in under the big arching glass roof, making people stamp their feet and button up their coats. The overhead polyphoto strips threw a bright blue-tinged light across the scene, illuminating the raindrops that lashed in past the edge of the roof like grey sparks.
Late to be travelling, isn't it?
Tarlo said as they walked toward the end of the platform. He ignored the curious glances their navy uniforms drew. Rennie pulled her jacket collar up against the cold and eyed the people lining the platform. They all seemed to be gathered in family clumps, with subdued yawning children sitting on piles of luggage. Several CST security guards were patrolling.
"Depends how keen you are to leave," she replied.
It was the first time she'd seen any evidence of the displacement that the Unisphere news shows featured so heavily these days. But then, if it was going to happen anywhere, she realized, it would be here. Most of Boongate's neighbors were numbered among the lost 23. They pushed their way through the equally crowded concourse and found the CST security office. Their liaison was Edmund Lee, a local police technical officer who'd been seconded to the Navy, then appointed to the newly formed Faraway Freight Inspectorate Division. He didn't bother wearing a Navy uniform, just a simple dove-gray office suit. Rennie was rather envious of that. Her dark tunic always seemed to itch. It reminded her of the time when Paula was still in charge of the Paris office. Lee had a car waiting, which drove them the 8 kilometers over to the faraway section of the yard. As he was briefing them on the latest interceptions, Rennie looked out through the rain-smeared glass. Hundreds of lights shone from tall poles across the extensive station yard, revealing the broad, empty regions between the rails and distant industrial buildings, a legacy of lost ambition left over from the days when Boongate thought it would become the junction for the adjoining sector of Phase 3 space. Some of the cargo depots were open, big rectangular doors showing trains drawn up inside, their wagons steaming and dripping as cranes and auto-lifters unloaded their consignments. She saw a long rank of Abel's RP-5 shunting engines lined up outside a giant engineering shop. Unused since the Prime attack sent the Commonwealth economy floundering, they awaited the return of normal commercial operations. A weak maroon light shimmered on the other side of the faraway cargo warehouse, glinting on the rails that snaked around outside. "Is that the halfway gateway?" Rennie asked. The semicircle of bland luminescence was coming into view from behind the long dark building as the car drew near. It resembled a tired moon sinking below the horizon. "Yeah," Edmund Lee said. "There's not been much outgoing traffic since the Prime attack. Most of it is cargo to companies and big landowners, and the Institute, of course. Not much personal stuff, either. Anyone who was planning on emigrating has put it on hold, and their tourist trade has packed up completely." "What about the traffic coming this way?" Tarlo asked. "Sure. Plenty of people want to get the hell out of there. Who wouldn't? They're damn close to Dyson Alpha, but it costs a lot to travel between Boongate and far away. Most don't have that kind of money. And I don't know how long the Commonwealth Civil Council will keep the gateway open." The car pulled up outside the warehouse, and they hurried through the rain to the small office attached to the side of the main building, like a brick wart. Inside, the office was a simple open-plan rectangle, with 9 desks down the middle. The console arrays on 7 of them were covered with plastic dust jackets. Tarlo gave them a curious look as they walked past. "How many staff does the division employ?" "There are 25 of us on the payroll," Edmund Lee said in a deadpan voice. "Right. And how many show up?" "It was 4 of us yesterday. Tomorrow, who knows?" Tarlo and Rennie gave each other a knowing glance. "I think that's called being absent without leave," Tarlo said. "The Admiral will probably have them shot." "He'll have to find them first," Edmund Lee told them. "I doubt they'll be on this world. They had families."
"So why are you still here?"
Rennie asked. "It's not like this is the most vital job in the Commonwealth right now.
I was born on Boongate. I guess that makes it easier for me to stay than the others. And I haven't started a family this life around."
He pushed through the door that led into the warehouse. It was chilly inside the cavernous space. A single row of poly photo strips was alight along the apex, casting a desultory light on the bare metal racks that ran the entire length of the enzyme-bonded concrete floor. Rain hitting the solar panel roof produced a loud drumming noise that reverberated around the nearly empty building.
"It gets kind of unnerving working here," Edmund Lee said.
He stepped over a set of rail tracks that ran down the middle of the floor to a huge door at the end of the warehouse.
"We are physically the closest people to the halfway gateway. If the Primes did come through, we'd be the first to know about it. You really feel exposed. I don't really blame the others for quitting."
They came to a pair of ordinary flatbed train wagons that were sitting on the track, both of them loaded with big gray composite crates. A deep scan sensor hoop spanned the track 20 meters away. Several desks had been set up around its base. Their screens and arrays were all silent and dark. A broad workbench beside them was equipped with several robotic machine tools. 3 of the crates sat on top of it. They'd been broken open.
"Urien found these yesterday,"
Edmund Lee gestured. The packing crates contained bulky sections of machinery that the power tools had split apart. Almost all of the electrical circuitry had been removed and laid out on the bench in a jumble of coiled cable and black box modules.
"All right. So what are we looking at?"
Tarlo asked.
"The machinery in this consignment is all agricultural. combine harvesters, tractors, drillers, irrigation systems. It's shipped in sections like this to be reassembled on far away. Makes life quite easy for us to scan it all. We were lucky Urien was on duty when this lot went through. His family are landowners on Dunedin. The man knows his farming tools. He thought there was something odd about the wiring, especially as these are all diesel-fueled. Turns out he was right. Edmund held up some of the cabling, which was as thick as his wrist. Heavy-duty superconductor. And these current modulators have a massive power rating. Not the manufacturer's spec, then, Tarlo said. Heavens, no. This is intended for something that uses a phenomenal amount of electricity. Any ideas? Edmund Lee grinned as he shook his head. I have absolutely no clue. That's why I made the call to your office. I thought you should know right away. Appreciate that. So, where was it heading? The address is for the Palomaro Ranch in the Taliong district. That's a long way east of Armstrong City. They say that's where the Barsoomians are. All right. What we really need are the shipment and financial details. Who was the agent? Which bank was used? Where was the machinery packed? Yeah. Edmund Lee scratched the back of his neck, giving the muddle of machinery a doubtful look. The rain pounding on the roof grew even louder as a dense squall lashed down. Look, I'm sure that back on Earth that kind of data is beautifully formatted and filed for instant access. Things are a little different here. For a start, some of this stuff is already missing.
Missing? Rennie exclaimed. What do you mean?
Exactly that. Everyone knows we keep expensive goods in here overnight. Take a look around, lady. Do you see any guard bots on patrol outside? We've got sensors, but even if an alarm goes off, the nearest CST security agent is 8 kilometers away over in the terminal. And right now, they're all real busy on crowd control. The police are farther away, and care even less.
God damn it,
Tarlo hissed. Did you manage to get a record of everything you found in this shipment? I'm pretty sure Urien recorded it, yes. There will be the deep scan sensor record, if nothing else. It just hasn't been loaded in our official database yet. It's probably in his console's temporary store folder. Rennie made a strong effort to keep her growing anger in check. No good shouting at Edmund Lee. They were lucky he had even bothered to call them. What about the associated data work? Tarlo asked about. Is that in a temporary folder somewhere?
No.
I haven't started rounding that up yet. It shouldn't take too long. A lot of the inventory and authorization will be filed with the station's faraway export control office.
How's their staffing level?
Tarlo asked bitterly. Edmund Lee just raised an eyebrow. Hogan is going to go apeshit, Rennie decided. Another setback. This case is truly jinxed.
Well, he needn't try blaming us, Tarlo said. But I'm beginning to understand why the boss never found any decent leads here.
It's only since the attack things have gotten like this, Edmund Lee said. It didn't help that this operation was still being set up at the time. I can't even complain about not having any money. It's a lack of people that is the problem.
Right, Tarlo said decisively. Rennie, there's no point in both of us staying here. You get back to Paris. I'll stay on and run the checks on this consignment. Once we have the basic source, routes, and finance information, we can start the backtrack operation from Paris.
Rennie gave the shaded, gaping warehouse a final examination. No argument. You'd better arrange for what's left to be shipped back as well. Forensics can start going over it. They might be able to tell us what it's for. Tarlo put out a hand to shake.
$10 they can't.
No takers. It was officially called the Westminster Palace Museum of Democracy, but as always, everyone just called it Big Ben, after the famous clock tower that stood guard at the eastern end. Adam Alvin used his credit tattoo to pay the standard entry fee and walked in through the ornate arching stonework of St. Stephen's entrance opposite the abbey.
With its lengthy halls, elongated windows, and bare stone interior, the old British Parliament building always gave him the impression of being a misappropriated cathedral. The lobby between the two main chambers had incongruous wooden furniture huddled defensively between big white statues, while gold-tinted light poured in through the vaulting stained-glass windows, highlighting the carvings that stretched up each wall. Groups of chattering schoolchildren rushed about, looking around through interface goggles as the guide program described the historical significance of everything they focused on. Doors into the commons were open, where holograms faded in and out above the chamber's green benches to produce images of successive politicians from the pre-electronic era right up until the last English Parliament in 2065. In the House of Lords, the whole rise and fall of the British monarchy from William the Conqueror at the Battle of Hastings to King Timothy signing the act to grant the right of self-determination to his people was played out amid spectral pomp and splendour. Adam ignored the Victorian Gothic grandeur and the dodgy history lessons to carry on through to the Terrace Café along the side of the Thames. It extended for over 200 metres, nearly the entire length of the building, and was always a popular spot for tourists and locals alike. A warm spring breeze coming off the wide river rustled the tall table parasols with their elaborate portcullis emblem. Waitresses threaded their way through the tight maze, delivering trays and taking orders. He had to suck in his stomach and slither his way awkwardly past seats, warding off annoyed glances, to reach a table that was right up against the terrace parapet itself. Bradley Johansson smiled up at him.
"Adam, so good of you to come, old chap."
"Yeah, right," Adam grunted, and sat down next to Bradley. A young waitress dressed in a faux Tudor boy's costume with emerald green tights showing off her long legs came over and smiled, hopefully. "Another afternoon tea for my friend," Bradley told her winningly, "with cream scones, and I think a glass of that delightful Gifford's champagne." Her smile brightened.
"Yes, sir."
"For Christ's sake," Adam muttered after she walked off. Everybody had to be looking at them.
"Now don't go all Bolshevik on me," Bradley chided. "When in Rome and all that. Besides, it's proper Cornish clotted cream."
"Whoop-de-fucking-do."
"Come on, Adam. They've turned this ancient seat of class privilege into a lovely tea shop for the common man. There's got to be a metaphor or two in that, surely. I thought you'd enjoy this."
Adam would never admit it, but he always experienced a slight burst of admiration for the way Bradley chose to meet him in the most outrageously public places. There was a kind of bravado about it that Adam's dreary, paranoid tradecraft would never permit.
"Casimir would have liked it," Adam said. The history on this world always amazed him. Nearly every building he went in was older than far away.
Bradley's affable expression hardened.
"What happened, Adam?"
"That data was vital." His hand slapped the table in fury. "People did look." Bradley's smile returned, meeting the stares apologetically. Adam didn't often get to see the claws. It wasn't nice.
"We pieced it together eventually. He sneaked off to see a girl before the courier mission. Apparently they met a long time ago back on Far Away. Turns out she was a little more important than your average tourist."
"Who is she?"
"Justine Bernelli."
"The senator?" Bradley blinked in surprise. "Well, bless the dreaming heavens. No wonder the Navy was on to him. I thought he was smarter than that. A lot smarter."
"Casimir was murdered by a Starflyer agent called Bruce McFoster. He and Casimir grew up together."
"Yes, I remember." Bradley picked up a little bone-handled silver knife and spread some cream on a scone. "Bruce never came back from a raid a few years back. Damn it. I keep telling the clans to watch for what the Starflyer can do to anyone left behind."
"The same thing it did to you?"
For a split second, Bradley registered enormous pain.
"Quite," he said hoarsely. "You know, I don't even question if the Starflyer is real anymore. I've watched young Kieran McSobel's recording a dozen times since. Casimir was delighted to see his friend again. And Bruce just shot him.
I'm sorry, Adam. Sorry. I thought you'd be delighted at another convert.
It isn't a pleasant door to open. There is little hope behind it, mostly just darkness and pain. That's why I founded the Guardians, to protect the human race from what lurks there, so they could carry on living their beautiful long lives in peace. In a way, you're not my convert. You're another of its victims. Hey, don't worry yourself about my soul. I chose my path a long time ago. This is just another rocky patch. Oh, Adam, if only you knew how much I envy your optimism. Ah. He smiled up again as the waitress brought a tray with Adam's afternoon tea.
Do tuck in.
Adam picked up his knife and cut open one of the scones. How good was the encryption? Bradley asked.
The SI could probably break it, but apart from that, it's safe.
That gives us some leeway, then. The Navy ran long-range diagnostic tests on the Martian equipment, which will tell them precisely nothing. They'll be desperate to find some subterfuge.
We watched the body afterward, you know.
Senator Bernelli had it taken to a New York clinic owned by her family. My little friend, Paula, accompanied her. From what we can gather, the Navy and Senate security doesn't exactly see eye to eye over this. Bradley held up his crystal champagne flute, studying the bubbles as they fizzed in the sunlight.
Do you think Paula has the memory crystal rather than the Navy?
That's some heavy-duty speculation, but I'll concede it is possible.
I wonder if that works to our advantage.
I don't see how. You needed the data.
They have it.
It gives them a big bargaining chip, even though they don't know it yet. Do we have anything they want?
Yes.
Bradley took a sip of champagne.
You and me, for a start.
Not fucking funny. Adam stuffed the scone into his mouth and started pouring his tea. I suppose not. But I have to give some consideration to recovering the information.
We need it, Adam. Very badly.
The whole of the planet's revenge depends on it.
I don't see how we can get it back.
I certainly don't have any way of infiltrating Navy intelligence or Senate security. What about that old top-level source of yours?
I'm afraid I haven't heard from him in a long time.
So that's it? Game over? Somehow the idea was impossible.
It's not over by any means, Bradley said.
Just a damn sight more difficult. That Martian data would have helped us refine the control program to a point where we could use it with confidence. We can still go ahead, but now we have to depend on numerical modeling more than the project designers want to. The results will be very uncertain.
Your guys will make it work, whatever it is. They all seem so dedicated.
For which I give thanks to the dreaming heavens. Humans do seem to possess remarkable reserves in so many fields. No wonder Starflyer and the Primes are so unnerved by us. If the Starflyer found out about the planet's revenge, could it prevent you from carrying it out? Bradley looked out over the river, giving the tall plane trees on the opposite bank a thoughtful stare.
Stop it? No.
But it would be easy to circumvent. Timing is critical. But very few of us know the entire strategy, and I remain in contact with all of them. So far, we are secure.
I hope you're right.
They knew Casimir was making his courier run, which implies they've penetrated the Navy. So by now they must know about the observatory receiving the Martian data for 20 years. If the Starflyer knows that, can it work out what you're planning to hit it with?
Extremely unlikely.
However, none of this will matter if we can't get the remaining physical components through to far away. An entire shipment was intercepted by the new Navy inspections on Boongate.
Yeah, we're really going to have to do something about that.
Adam dropped some rock sugar into his tea and stared absently.
We've got outlines of a blockade-busting run drawn up. I guess it's about time to put some flesh on it. Not that it needs a lot of development.
It's an essentially crude notion to begin with.
Good.
That means there's less which can go wrong.
And you call me an optimist.
I'm still curious how Bruce managed to get away afterward.
Did you find out anything relevant about that train he jumped on?
No.
CST traffic control uses very high-order encryption. He grinned. For some reason, they're worried about people like me hacking in. It was a freight train, is all we know. We don't know where it was going, only that it was in the right place at the right time. That kind of placement takes some doing. It impressed the hell out of me. Logically, then, it had to be organized by someone very senior in CST. I wonder who the Starflyer has corrupted in that organization. I don't suppose we'll find out until all this is long over and settled. Bradley gave a reluctant moo. Yes, unfortunately. But someone that highly placed can do a lot of damage. I'm assuming they'll help the Starflyer in its arrangements to return to Faraway. You're convinced that will happen?
I am indeed.
It can't afford to be trapped in the Commonwealth, especially if the Primes do succeed in wreaking havoc. When the war is at its very worst, it will try and return to its own kind. That's when we must strike. We'll get the rest of your equipment through. Don't worry. I don't, Adam. I have a lot of confidence in you and your team. I just wish I could convince the rest of the Commonwealth. Perhaps I went about this the wrong way right from the start. But nobody believed me back then. I felt as though my back was to the wall. What else could I do but lash out physically? It was such a ridiculously human reaction, one which betrays how insecure we all are, how short the distance we've traveled from the old animal. Forming the Guardians to attack the Institute was such an instinctive reaction. Maybe I should have tried the political route. Speaking of which, are you absolutely sure Elaine Doy is a Starflyer agent? Bradley leaned forward over the table. That wasn't us. Excuse me? A very well-executed fake. I have to admit, the Starflyer is becoming quite sophisticated in its campaign against us. Physically, Bruce and his kind are causing a lot of expensive damage. While disinformation like that shotgun is damaging our credibility. Just when we were starting to attract a degree of media interest, not to mention political support. Still, I blame myself. I should have anticipated such a move. Adam finally sipped some of the Gifford's champagne to help wash down a scone. You know, that might have been a dangerous move on their part. In what way? If anyone was to investigate that shotgun properly, they might pick up some leads. The Starflyer might have exposed some of its operation to official scrutiny. Worth considering. I certainly wasn't going to issue a disclaimer. That would make us look really stupid in the public mind. In any case, I'm abandoning the propaganda shotguns anyway. We're too close to the end now for them to make any real difference to general opinion. Unless you can produce some absolute proof.
True.
Bradley seemed very undecided.
I suppose the Doy shotgun could do with some further inquiries.
I can't spare anyone from my team, especially now you've recalled Stig. Sorry about that, but I needed him back on Faraway. He's developed into a damn good leader, for which I place full credit on your training. So we have no one who can dig into the shotgun. See who put it together. I'll see what I can do. Wilson said practically nothing on the journey back to the High Angel. He was lost in his virtual vision, pulling files from the Navy Intelligence Paris office and reviewing the tight green text as it scrolled through the air in front of him. It went well, Raphael said as the Direct Express slid out of Newark. I expected us to take a much bigger beating than that. They are politicians, after all.
Doy was surprising, Wilson admitted, rousing himself from Hogan's report on the killing at L.A. Galactic. I didn't expect her to be quite as forthright as that. She had to be. We need someone with balls at the top. Everybody there knew that. The dynasties and grand families would have engineered a recall if she didn't come up with positive noises. So it looks like we'll get the ships then.
Yeah. Raphael shrugged at the lack of communication and settled back to work through the files in his own virtual vision. Wilson thought the account of how the killer got away was frankly unbelievable.
If that was an example of how the Paris office operated, no wonder Raphael had fired Mayo. He looked through the spectral lines and columns and graphics to see Raphael sitting opposite him. The man was ambitious, yes, but no matter how ambitious and well-connected you were, to reach his level, you also had to be competent. Hogan was his placement, but Inspector Mayo was renowned across the Commonwealth. It didn't seem like a move based purely on petty office politics. There was no prejudice or simple maneuvering. Mayo hadn't produced results. She had to go. Yet she'd immediately been recruited into Senate security, a move engineered by the Bernellis. And Justine had clashed with Raphael. Wilson recalled the one previous time he'd met the chief investigator, amid the ruins of Assessment Hall 7 on Anshun after the Guardian's attack on Second Chance. She'd seemed quietly professional, easily living up to her reputation. And she certainly hadn't acquired her seniority in the directorate through family connections. She was frighteningly good at her job. Every case but one solved. Even now it seemed she was still working on that one, simply from a different angle, if he was reading the pattern right. His virtual hands pulled another file from the Paris office. Mayo had accompanied McFoster's body to the Bernelli Biomedical Facility for its autopsy. He found it hard to believe that she would ever jeopardize any kind of investigation simply to score points off Raphael. Her brain simply wasn't wired for it, thanks to the Human Structure Foundation, which meant she thought there was something deeper behind the appearance of the assassin. He pulled her last few reports on the case from the Navy files, interested to see how high the restricted access level was. There were only 15 people in the Commonwealth government who could gain entry to those files. Paula Mayo, it seemed, had come to believe that the Starflyer was real.
Son of a bitch.
Raphael gave him an expectant look. Wilson shook his head in mild embarrassment and sat back deeper into the train's seat. His immediate political instinct was to stay out of a clash between the Bernellis and the Halgarths, especially over something like this. But for Mayo to even consider the possibility after 130 years trying to close down the Guardians was extraordinary. Everybody knew the chief investigator was incapable of lying. Every time he'd accessed one of her cases, the Unisphere shows would relay her parents' trial as evidence of just how incorruptible she was. Wilson began to wish he'd simply walked on by that morning when Justine had asked him for a moment. But he knew it wasn't something he could ignore. The Red Planet had a resonance he could never ignore. What the hell did the Guardians want with Mars? As he pulled out the most recent files from the investigation, it was clear that Navy intelligence didn't have a clue. And just as Mayo indicated, they were winding down that aspect of the case.
"My E-Butlers flagged an interesting report," he said casually. "What were the Guardians doing on Mars?"
Raphael's focus returned to the real world.
"We don't know.
The Guardians' courier was killed, and whatever data he was carrying has disappeared. Between you and me, I believe it wound up at Senate Security. Senator Bernelli's interest in this case is less than professional."
"Really?
I'll see if I can have a word with Gore about that. He owes me a few favors from way back."
"I'd appreciate that. Sometimes I'm not sure we're all working for the same side. The damn grand families can't stop looking for a financial angle on everything."
"No problem. But I'd like you to keep Navy intelligence working on Mars. I have an understandable interest in the place."
Raphael gave a disinterested grin.
"Sure."
Wilson and Anna's apartment in Babuyan Atoll was in a building resembling a small pyramid of dove-gray bubbles. It was close to the edge of the vast crystal dome, which gave them a clear view out into space at night when the internal illumination dimmed. When the High Angel was in conjunction, the one light from Aikal and Isis's gigantic cloudscape was enough to cast pale shadows across the walls and floors. That was frequently complemented by the waxing and waning moonlight from the gas giant's major satellites. Wilson would often spend an evening on the oval terrace outside the living room,
sitting in a recliner with a glass of wine in one hand, watching the stark alien planets gliding overhead. Even then he would immerse himself in files and priority office work that his e-butler and virtual vision provided. The night when he got back from the war cabinet meeting was different. He simply couldn't push Mars out of his thoughts.
"I expected you to be happier,"
Anna said as she came out onto the terrace. For once, she'd taken the time to change out of her uniform after they got home. She'd put on a small yellow bikini and long, semi-transparent yellow robe. Her dark skin made the fabric appear bright in the infall of light from various moons. Silver and bronze ock tattoos all across her body came to life in long, slow undulations, emphasizing the play of muscle below her skin. The effect was erotic enough to divert Wilson's thoughts from Mars. He whistled admiringly as she perched on the edge of the recliner.
"I haven't seen you like that for quite a while."
"I know. We seem to be neglecting some fairly basic human requirements lately. It's all Mr. and Ms. No Fun Military Executive these days."
"Just how basic were those requirements you had in mind?"
Her finger stroked the side of his face.
"I had my staff draw up a list. They'll get in touch with your people and start negotiations."
"Anytime soon?"
He slipped his arm around her waist and told his e-butler to get her a glass of the wine. She settled back into the embrace and stared up through the roof of the dome.
"Is that the new assembly platform?"
Wilson followed where she was looking to see a silver fleck amid the stars.
Yeah, I think so. You know, space is going to get pretty cluttered out there over the next few months."
"If we have months."
His hold around her tightened.
"They're not invincible. Don't ever let yourself think that. We've seen their home star. We know they have finite resources to throw at us."
"They might be finite, Wilson, but they've got a damn sight more than we have."
A maid bot rolled up, carrying a glass of chilled wine. He took it from the electromuscle tentacle and handed it to Anna.
"If they could have invaded every Commonwealth planet at once, they would have done it. They can't. They have to try and digest us, one chunk at a time. I'm not saying we shouldn't be frightened of them, but if that first attack showed us anything, it's that they have limits. The effort they made establishing themselves on the Lost 23 gives us a breathing space. We'll make those fancy new ships work. We'll gather an army of people wet-wired with the scariest weapons technology we can think of and kick the Lost 23 out from under their quadruple feet.
And after that, we'll use the Seattle Project to put the fear of God into them.
It'll be us deciding if they get to live or not. Those sons of bitches will curse the day their barrier wall ever came down."
"Wow. You really believe we can do this, don't you?"
"I have to. I'm not going to let the human race become nothing more than an old legend in this part of the galaxy.
You can depend on me." She kissed him lightly.
"I know."
He touched his glass to hers. "A toast."
"To a successful campaign, and politicians who didn't actually spend the whole cabinet meeting trying to score points off each other."
"I'll drink to that."
Wilson savored the wine, then glanced up at the Base One hardware floating close to the High Angel.
"I've seen the ideas the physicists and designers have. They're goddamn impressive.
Let's hope the media shows stop criticizing everything we try and do."
"They will. Baron and the others are just in shock, like everyone else. Once they sober up and see what the alternative is, they'll throw their weight behind us. I've seen it happen before."
She rubbed his hair fondly.
"So old.
I guess that's what makes me trust you so much. You have so much life experience. I don't think there's any situation you couldn't handle."
"Don't be so sure. I've got surprising vulnerabilities. I can't believe how much Mars is bugging me.
Justine really pressed the right buttons there. What do you think the Guardians have been doing there all that time? I've been sitting here thinking about it for an hour, and I just cannot figure it out.
That's why I asked Raphael to keep his teams on it.
But given the dumbass politics involved, I don't suppose much will be done.
How about I become the buffer on this one for you? I've got the authority to press for action in Navy intelligence, while you stay outside the low-level office bickering. Wilson stretched his neck up to kiss her. That would be just about perfect. I do what I can. The Ock tattoos on her torso began to pick up speed, reflecting the light of the shining moons in slim lines of glinting steel. What say we forget our staff and just do our own negotiations here and now? Anna started giggling as he shifted in the recliner so that both arms could reach around her. Nigel Sheldon's memory trigger was fast and completely unexpected. It snapped a scene around him like a high-res TSI access, putting him back in front of the TV news in his adolescence, where every large-scale disaster was followed up by politicians on a reassurance visit to the hospitals or tent city aid stations. After the 2048 meteor strike tsunami in the Gulf of Mexico, students on campus had printed out cards like the ones carried by volunteer organ donors, but saying, "In the event of emergency, keep the president away from me." Watching Elaine Doy and her entourage working their way along the queue outside the temporary medical station, Nigel wondered how many of these refugees would appreciate having that card on them right now. There wasn't much in the way of smiles and gratitude down there, only grim resignation and an undercurrent of anger. As yet, it wasn't directed at her. His retinal inserts zoomed back out, giving him a broad aspect of the Wessex Planetary Station. Like all the CST stations on Big 15 worlds, the one at Narrabree sprawled over several hundred square kilometers, incorporating marshalling yards, management centers, engineering sectors, cargo warehouses, a small town of office blocks, and passenger terminals. In the aftermath of the Prime invasion, it had become the clearinghouse for every refugee from the last 23, all 40 million of them. The CST Passenger Train Management, RI, had pulled out every piece of rolling stock on the Commonwealth Register to cope, from vintage carriages to the modern maglev expresses. Even the steam engine that ran on the Huxley's Haven line had been used a couple of times. The evacuation had been a truly heroic endeavor, relentless and grueling for everyone involved, from the managers, who suddenly found themselves coping with a catastrophe they'd never envisioned, let alone trained for, to station staff, helping entire planetary populations flood through their domain while nuclear weapons exploded overhead and their homes were blasted back into the Stone Age. Somehow, it had worked. Nigel had never been prouder of his people. At the start, when the rail network was in true chaos, people had been swarming through the gateways on foot from the last 23. But after a few hours, CST had re-established the primary rail links and begun running evacuation trains. They'd offloaded refugees throughout Phase 1 and 2 space on a rota basis, with trains abandoning their confused and frightened cargo at stations for the local government to cope with. Nobody asked permission to dump people from wildly different ethnic groups and cultures and religions onto unprepared worlds, frightened for their own future. CST simply did it based on practicality. From the Narrabree CST station manager's office, Nigel could see a mass of people milling around outside the huge buildings of the engineering sector. Repairs and maintenance on Wessex were currently impossible, with crude dormitories and makeshift kitchens filling every square meter of floor space. Even with all the temporary facilities rushed in, sanitation down there wasn't great. But at least the big engineering sheds gave them a roof over their heads at night. Tens of thousands more camped out in the terminal buildings, eating their way through every fast food franchise stall on the planet. More squatted in empty warehouses. Best estimates from CST staff and Wessex government officials on the ground put the number remaining in the station at 2 million. Social workers brought in from 50 planets and local volunteers from Narrabree were coping with children separated from their parents. Over 30% were newly orphaned and deep in shock. There were acts of kindness and quiet heroism occurring amid the throng that would never be known for all the intrusive media coverage of the terrible human aftermath of the invasion.
I haven't seen anything like this since the early 21st century, Nigel said.
Yeah, I remember Africa and Asia back then, Alan Hutchinson said. This isn't quite the same.
Nigel cast an inquisitive glance at the third dynasty leader in the office. Heather Antonia Halgarth gazed down impassively at the weary refugees without making any comment.
We're doing everything we can, Nigel said. It shouldn't take more than a couple of days to move these people out.
Where to?
Alan asked.
My senators are starting to hear complaints. Some worlds think they're being given too many refugees to cope with.
Tough, Nigel snapped.
We can't dump them on Phase 3 worlds. There's no infrastructure. Phase 1 and 2 will have to cope physically and financially.
But not Earth, Heather murmured. Nigel gave her an uneasy smile. She was nearing the time she underwent rejuvenation, a biological age of mid-50s. It made her an imposingly grand woman with reddish hair starting to lighten and a few wrinkles appearing on her cheeks. At this time in her preferred sequence, he always likened her to some high priestess, silent, wise, knowing, and totally uncompromising.
Gnome, he said. Not Earth. They'll get a few token trainloads, but I can really do without the grandees bitching about undesirables bringing down the tone of the neighborhood. My Unisphere address would be blocked for a year with messages. They can pay for accommodation instead. I made that quite clear to Crispin.
Good man, Crispin, Heather said.
He'll need to be, Alan said.
Sorting this mess out will cost trillions.
And it'll take a decade, if not longer.
Screw it. This is nearly 15% of my market those alien bastards have wiped out.
We might all be facing 100% market loss sooner than we would like, Heather said in a voice loaded with contempt. I have yet to be convinced that our new Navy is capable of engaging the prime threat effectively. What I've seen so far doesn't exactly fill me with confidence. Losing 23 planets in a day is simply unacceptable.
We agreed to back the formation of a Navy, Nigel said pointedly. I don't know what else we could have done.
Yeah, Alan grunted.
It's not exactly underfunded. Relative to a species extinction crusade, which is what this is, I think we could have made more effort.
Nigel nodded to the knot of people around Doi. Politically difficult.
Which is why we dump them every 5 years, Heather said. We make the decisions, us Humble Three and the other dynasties. Doi will do as she's told, as will the Senate.
Not all of them, Nigel said. Don't be that arrogant.
We built this civilization, Heather said.
You more than all of us, Nigel. We cannot stand back when there are hard choices to be made.
This is all academic anyway, Nigel countered. We've lost those planets. Our warship-building program cannot be significantly expanded for months, no matter how much we need more ships.
Do we need more ships? Heather asked mildly. There's the Seattle project.
Genocide them?
Nigel was surprised to hear her propose that option. He'd always assumed she favored a less drastic solution. Not that he'd ever thought of one. I think this has proved it's either them or us, surely.
They're aggressive, yes, but genocide? Come on, that's got to be the last resort. I don't think we're at that stage yet.
You're applying human scruples to a non-human problem. Their next attack will be bigger and stronger. And we know there's going to be a next, don't we?
Once the Navy finds the exit point of that massive wormhole the Primes constructed, we'll be able to block them, Alan said.
Heather gave him a disappointed smile. Eliminate Hell's Gateway. Care to bet your life on that? Because that's what you're doing.
Fuck you, Alan spat. It's my territory that's in the front line.
Let's just calm down here, Nigel said.
Heather, he's right. We have to give the Navy a chance to do what we built it for.
I'm not prepared to authorize the genocide of an entire species, however belligerent.
And after their next strike takes out half of Phase 2 space?
Then I'll press the button myself.
I'm glad to hear it. In the meantime, I will be taking the same kind of precautions you've been doing for the last few months. Nigel sighed. He should have known the other dynasties would eventually find out what he was doing.
Yeah, well, I'm just playing safe. That's a very expensive way of being safe, Alan said.
How much are you spending on those ships?
I mean, Christ, Nigel, the hole in Augusta's budget was big enough for us to find.
Which is why I don't understand your reluctance to genocide the Primes, Heather said. She sounded genuinely curious.
Morality. We all have it, Heather, to some degree or other.
And your morality includes flying off and leaving the rest of us in the shit, does it?
If those ships are ever used, it will be when we're past the point of salvation. There won't be any Commonwealth left to protect.
Well, I hope you're not going to deny us equal access to your hyperdrive technology. Nigel couldn't help the flicker of disapproval on his face.
Progressive wormhole generator.
Excuse me?
FTL starships use progressive wormhole generators.
Right, Alan said, nonplussed. Whatever.
We need them, Nigel.
His hand waved down at the refugees.
Given this crock of shit, I'm putting my dynasty's escape route together. All of us are. You can have generators for your ships, Nigel said. I'll be happy to sell them to you.
Thank you, Heather said. In the meantime, we'd better present a united front for the War Cabinet and the Senate. She nodded down at the President.
She has to be given a big injection of confidence.
People will turn to her. They always do in times of crisis. If they can see for certain that she's firmly in charge, it'll help keep the panic down.
Sure. Nigel shrugged.
What about Wilson? Alan asked.
What about him? Nigel said.
Oh, come on. 23 worlds invaded, and Wessex targeted as well.
That asshole let it happen. He's responsible. He's the best one for the job, Nigel said. You can't replace him.
For now, Heather said. But another screw-up like this, and we will eject him.
He gave her a hard look. And replace him with Raphael.
He's pro-genocide.
That gets my vote. We don't need games right now, Heather.
Who's playing? We're facing extinction, Nigel. If the solution involves shifting the Navy to my control, then that is what will happen. Nigel couldn't remember the two of them going raw like this before. The trouble with Heather was that she could only think in terms of everything that had gone before. She had an astonishing determination and political ability. You couldn't build a dynasty without those qualities. Nigel always considered her flaw to be a lack of originality. Even now, she saw the Prime situation purely in terms of its effect on her dynasty.
If that's the only solution you can see, then go for it, he told her.
It drew him a suspicious look. He ignored it. If she couldn't see her way around this problem, he certainly wasn't going to tell her. Despite all she'd triumphed through on Ilan, Melanie still felt a great deal of trepidation as she stepped up to the dark wooden door of Paula Mayo's Parisian apartment block. It said a lot about the Hive woman that just the idea of confronting her again could do that. Melanie knew that she was the special one now, that the SI inserts gave her huge powers, that she actually had the courage to stand in front of the Morning Light Mountain soldier motiles and take them down. Well, the SI had through her, but that didn't alter the fact that she hadn't turned tail and run. So why do I feel so nervous? She checked the bulky centuries-old intercom box beside the door and pressed the worn ceramic button for Paula Mayo's apartment. Somewhere inside a buzzer sounded. Her e-butler immediately told her Paula Mayo was placing a call to her Unisphere address. Melanie resisted the instinct to look around for a camera. Even if the sensor was big enough to be visible, it was late evening, and the sunlight had almost faded, dropping the narrow street into deep shadow.
Above her, the windows looking out from the high walls were all shuttered. The few intermittent streetlights above the uneven pavement did little to alleviate the gloom.
"Yes?"
Paula Mayo asked.
"I need to see you,"
Melanie said.
"I don't need to see you, but I did what you said. I talked to Dudley Bowes."
"And what has that got to do with me?" Melanie gave the door an aggravated stare.
"You were right. I did find something interesting."
"Which was?"
"The star flyer."
There was such a long pause that Melanie thought Mayo had cut her off. She had to check her virtual vision to confirm the channel was still open. The lock clicked loudly. Melanie just had time to square her shoulders before the door opened. She'd toned down her clothes for this encounter, selecting some of the more sober items from her personal fashion line, a half-sleeve burgundy jacket and matching skirt longer than her usual, its hem nearly halfway to her knees. It was a compilation that should emphasize how serious and professional she was these days. A single polyphoto circle was fixed to the top of the deep archway that led to the block's central courtyard. Paula Mayo was silhouetted in its yellow glow, dressed in her usual conservative-cut business suit. Melanie hadn't realized before, but she was taller than the investigator.
"Come in," Paula said.
Melanie followed her to the middle of the ancient cobbled courtyard. She looked around at the whitewashed walls with their narrow windows. Over half of them had their shutters drawn back, revealing glimpses of rooms. Flickers of pale green light were coming from inside as holographic portals played out the evening's Unisphere news and entertainment. A sad reflection on the residents. This was the kind of block where single professionals would flock while they were taking a break between marriage contracts. Sanitized little apartments where they could rest in safety between the work and play that otherwise occupied their whole day.
"This will do," Paula said. "We're secure here, if we don't talk too loud."
Melanie wasn't sure about that, but didn't want to argue.
"You know about it, don't you?
Did Alessandra Baron send you in search of an exclusive?
Is that why you're here?" "No."
Melanie gave a short, edgy laugh.
"I don't work for her anymore."
"Check with the production company if you don't believe me."
"I will."
"Why did you leave?"
"I imagine it was quite lucrative. And your report from Rand Town helped secure your celebrity status." "She works for the Starflyer."
Paula tilted her head to one side and gave Melanie a searching look.
"That's an interesting allegation.
But don't you see it makes perfect sense? She's always been tough on the Navy. She's just spinning the Starflyer's propaganda, causing trouble for the one organization which can defend us."
"You used her show to criticize me. Does that make you a Starflyer agent?"
"No. Look, I want to help. I know about the cop. That's how I found out about Baron. When I told her, she altered the records."
"I'm sorry. You've lost me now. What is this Cox?"
A little flare of temper made Melanie put her hands on her hips. This wasn't going the way she'd imagined it. She'd thought the investigator would welcome offers of help from anyone who knew about the Starflyer and the huge danger it represented.
"The education charity,"
she said acerbically, which should jog the hive woman's memory. "The one that funded Dudley's observation."
"The break-in,"
Paula said, reading something in her virtual vision.
"The Guardian suspected the whole Bowes observation was a deliberate manipulation."
"And they were right." Paula's eyebrows lifted slightly.
"Really?"
"You know they were," Melanie hissed.
"I don't."
"But you must have. The Cox is a total fraud."
"Not according to our investigations."
"But..." Melanie felt the skin down the back of her neck cooling rapidly. She didn't understand the way Mayo was reacting at all. Unless the Starflyer had got to her as well.
"I'm sorry. I'm wasting your time. It was tough on Ilan."
She turned and hurried back to the door. Backing off from people she used to trust was turning into a bad habit.
"Wait,"
Paula said. Melanie froze, suddenly fearful. She reviewed the icons in her virtual vision, trying to work out if she could use any of the SI inserts to extricate herself if things turned nasty. Trouble was, she didn't really understand half of them yet. She'd have to yell to the SI for help. The gold snakeskin of her virtual hand poised above the SI icon.
"You think I know something about the Cocks?" Paula said.
"Why?"
"You put me on to Dudley Bowes. You must have known I would discover this."
"I pushed you toward Bowes because his wife once met Bradley Johansson. I was expecting you to go down that route to the Starflyer. Media allies would be useful to me. The only reports I recall on the break-in were that the Cox charity was legitimate."
"It's not."
"Well, it wasn't.
Baron had the records altered."
"Interesting. If you're telling me the truth, then the actual state of the Cox was withheld from me."
"I am telling the truth," Melanie protested.
She almost said, "Ask the SI," but that would have given away too much. She still didn't trust Paula.
"All right," Paula said. "I'll look into it."
"Then what?"
"What did you come here for?"
"To see what you were doing and to help.
And coincidentally wind up with the ultimate story.
Were you going to keep it secret?"
"If it's all true, then no.
But I really don't think having a media celebrity dogging everything I do is helpful, do you?" She couldn't even say, "reporter," Melanie thought.
"Bitch."
"Fine. Whatever." She pushed at the big door, opening a way back out onto the relative safety of the street.
"If you do find anything concrete, then please come to me," Paula said.
"Not the Navy."
"Right."
Melanie took a few paces out, then stopped to gather her thoughts. She knew she'd unsettled Paula, but pleasant though it was, that wasn't what she'd wanted to achieve. Right now, Melanie needed someone to turn to with the terrible knowledge of Baron and the Starflyer, someone in authority, someone who would do something about it, just like some kid running to her parents. Well, if the great Paula Mayo was suspicious or undecided, she'd just have to damn well sort the problem out herself. With that thought, Melanie nodded her head confidently and set off for the nearest metro station. Dawn found Hosha Finn on his balcony, slumped in a cheap plastic patio chair looking out across the twinkling urban grid. Oak Tear's sun was sliding up over the eastern districts of Dark Lake City, cloaking the tips of the glass and marble towers with an energetic rose-gold glow. Colorful birds started chirping from inside the tall evergreen trees standing around the base of his apartment block, while garden bots moved among the narrow moat of dew-moistened gardens, performing their daily tidy-up routine. Sometime in the small hours, he'd woken up in the middle of the dream again, jolting up on the bed in a fever sweat as the two real images of collapsing buildings and quaking ground drained away into the darkness of the room. Every night since the Prime attack, it had been the same. He refused to call it a nightmare. This was just his subconscious coming to terms with what had happened. All very healthy. Playing it back in sleep time, letting all those nasty little details wind out from his mind where they'd been compressed like some secure file in a crystal lattice. Like the woman who'd been crushed in two by a broken bridge support, glanced at briefly as he'd carried Inima past. The children wailing outside the smoking rubble that had been their house, lost and dazed, filthy with dust, soot, and blood. Yeah, a really healthy way of dealing with it all. So he'd pulled on his old amber bathrobe and limped out onto the balcony to watch the sleeping city, thinking like some frightened kid that maybe dreams only came to people in bedrooms. He dozed fitfully for the rest of the night as his burns throbbed and the clammy ache down his back cycled from hot to cold over and over. Not even the rum and hot chocolate helped. It just made him feel sick. What he wanted was Inima. The reassurance of having her lying beside him at night. The exasperated tolerance she turned on whenever he was ill and moping around the house instead of going into work.
but the doctors weren't going to let her out of the hospital for another 10 days at the earliest. He still tensed up every time he thought about her. Pulling her out from the broken 4x4 on Sligo, the way her legs were bent and blackened, fluid weeping from the tar-like encrustation that had been her jeans. Her low whimpers, the sounds that only the seriously injured make. A few vague memories of first aid flitting through his brain, utterly useless, as he stared at his wife in disbelief that anything like this could possibly happen, cursing himself the whole time for being so helpless. They were vacationing on Sligo to see the flower festival. A fucking flower festival. And an alien army came dropping down out of the sky, blowing the whole world to shit. Someone rang the apartment's doorbell. Osha turned automatically and grimaced at the number of twinges that triggered right across his body. Grumbling like an old man, he limped his way to the door and opened it. Paula Mayo stood outside, neat and tidy as always, in some charcoal grey business suit with a scarlet blouse. Her hair had been brushed to a gloss, hanging free behind her shoulders. She was studying him carefully, and he was abruptly self-conscious of the way he looked, the fact that he hadn't stood up to the attack the way he knew other people had. Instead of some lecture or trite comment, Paula gave him a gentle hug. Osha thought he covered up any surprise at the display of affection reasonably well, given the circumstances. "I'm really pleased you're okay, Osha," Paula said. "Thanks. Come on in." He glanced across the living room as she walked past him. Maidbots had kept the apartment clean, but it was obvious he was spending a lot of time at home, indoors. The room had an almost bachelor feel to it, with memory crystals, mugs, plates, and a long paper screen scattered over the table, blinds half-drawn, clothes piled up in one chair. "I brought you this," Paula said, and gave him a fancy-looking box of herbal teas. "Somehow I thought flowers would be inappropriate." Osha examined the label on the side of the box and grinned sheepishly. "Good choice." The sleeves of his robe were baggy, revealing long strips of heel skin on his arms. Paula saw them and frowned slightly. "How's Inima?" "The doctors say she'll be out of the hospital in another week or so. She'll need a clone graft for her hip and thigh, but they didn't have to amputate, thank God. They're going to fit her in an electromuscle suit, so she'll be mobile around the apartment at least."
"That's good."
He dropped down into one of the chairs.
"Medically, yeah. Our insurance is refusing to pay out for, quote, war injuries, unquote. They say the government is responsible for covering its citizens in times of conflict. Bastards. The decades I spent paying my premiums. I'm talking to a lawyer I know. He's not optimistic."
"What does the government say?"
"Which one?" "Oakshire says it isn't responsible for something that happened to registered citizens off-planet, because that's beyond their jurisdiction. The Intersolar Commonwealth? Well, we're kind of busy right now. Can I get back to you on that? We had to use the mortgage we raised for having a kid to pay the hospital."
"I'm sorry."
"Right now it doesn't seem like a terribly good idea to have a child anyway."
Osha growled it out, using anger to override the anguish. If he didn't, he knew he'd do something ridiculous like start crying.
"I accessed the prime attack on the Unisphere," Paula said, "but I don't suppose that can ever substitute for being there. It was mayhem on Sligo. Absolute mayhem. We were lucky to get out. After what happened there, I'm never going to complain about a Halgarth ever again. That force field took about 8 direct hits from prime nuclear missiles when we were inside it, and it never even wavered. The ground shocks were bad, though. I was in California once when they had a quake. That was nothing compared to this. I mean, buildings were collapsing all around us. The roads buckled right away. You couldn't use any kind of vehicle. I heard you headed up one of the evacuation squads. Yeah, well, they were appealing for anyone with any kind of government service connection. It's an authority thing. The local council didn't put a lot of police on duty for a flower festival." "Don't be so modest, Osha.
It's not like I ever expect a medal or anything. It was mainly self-preservation. She indicated his arm. How bad were you hurt?
Burns, mostly. Nothing too serious. The worst bit was the wait for treatment afterward. It was 10 hours before Anima even saw a nurse, and that was just for triage. It was actually easier for us to get back here and go to our local hospital than wait for the Navy's cobbled-together relief operation to finally catch up with us.
So now what?
Same as everyone else. Carry on as normally as possible, and hope that Admiral Keim does a better job next time around.
I see. I came here to offer you a job, Usher. I'm working at Senate Security now. I need an assistant. Someone I know can do a good job, and someone I know I can trust.
That's very flattering, he said carefully. But I'm not really that keen on the Commonwealth Administration right now.
That's not you talking, Usher. That's a whole lot of confusion left over from Sligo.
Very psychologically astute, I'm sure.
You want me to go on and list medical benefits? How good the family health plan is?
No.
He clenched his teeth, trying to come up with a valid reason why he shouldn't accept the offer.
What about your old office team?
Why not approach them?
I still don't know which of them I can trust.
I received some disturbing information yesterday, which adds to the likelihood one or more of them is working for the Starflyer alien. It took a moment for Hosha to place the name.
The one the Guardians keep banging on about.
You're kidding me.
I wish I was.
The dream flashed through his brain again, its blurred montage of misery and destruction falling from the sky in blinding purple contrails, moving barely slower than light speed. And that was just what one alien species could do. If there was another, something deeper and more sinister. I opened some of those Guardian shotguns. It all seemed pretty paranoid stuff to me. Something a freaked-out kid would babble about after his first bad trip.
That would be a favorable result, proving Bradley Johansson really has been wrong all these years.
I'm not used to doubts on this scale, Husha. I find it unnerving.
He thought about it.
No, not true. What he considered was how he would explain to Anima that he'd taken the new job.
I'm not going to be much use for any active role. Not for a week or so.
I wanted you to start by reviewing some old files for me. Now that we know what we're looking for, they might be more helpful than the last time I looked through them.
So what exactly is the deal with those medical benefits?